Listeners, you drink coffee? Well, here's the lowdown. Coffee's best when you drink it fresh, and I don't mean brewed fresh, I mean roasted fresh. You gotta use freshly roasted beans unless you're daft. But here's the wrench. Coffee you buy in the supermarket, who knows when it was roasted? Could have been yesterday, could have been last year. So what's a discerning dark roast drinker to do? Well, what you do is you stop wasting your time, you go right to sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug whips up their Joe with only premium Arabica beans directly sourced and fairly traded. They've got lots of different blends to choose from, including decaf and half caf, but what really makes Sparkplug Coffee so swell is they deliver this coffee to you within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You can even set up autopilot, set it, forget it delivery so that you don't have to worry about running out of coffee when you're too busy chasing stories to get to the store. If you love coffee as much as a true newspaper man loves the sound of a distant siren promising a scoop, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Sounds like somebody just had some coffee before that. And what a scoop!
Top 100!
Top 100!
Top 100!
Project!
And action!
Hey there, everybody, and thanks for eavesdropping on the Next 100 Project, the follow-up to our completed reviews of AFI movies. Heads up, you fast-talking newspaper people, because we will spoil this picture. I'm Ryan Ellis, and my co-host of this podcast, and my girl Friday is my wife Bev.
That's me.
So the coming attraction is trivia for this week's picture, His Girl Friday. How many of Cary Grant's 8 movies that made AFI's Top 100 Laughs list were in the top 30?
One of them is His Girl Friday, which is number 19. There are 3 more, making 4 in total. He had Bringing Up Baby, Philadelphia Story, and Arsenic and Old Lace.
Number 14, number 15, and number 30. That's right. And then, as I said, 8 in total out of 100 movies, so nearly a tenth. This guy actually is well represented on all the AFI lists. You get the thrillers, and obviously the main list, the laughs, and so on.
Well, as far as the laughs go, he is so funny in this movie.
And in many others, too. Okay, the Next 100 Project's 17th flick, His Girl Friday, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100s, but, of course, since we're covering it now, it didn't make it. Columbia Pictures tossed the movie out in January 1940. 'Twas not a big success. But this movie is so old now, Bev, you should probably describe it for people with a skin.
Cary Grant is Walter Burns, the editor of a New York newspaper. Rosalind Russell is his ex-wife, Hildy Johnson, who also used to be his ace reporter. When Walter finds out she's getting remarried and moving to Albany, he lures her into covering one last story.
Or, in a nutshell, Cary Grant could be a fucking dick!
Yeah, he's a real piece of work in this movie.
He's very dishonest, and he's not fair to Bruce, the Ralph Bellamy character that she's going to marry. Okay, the numbers first. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 97% of them are in favor of His Girl Friday, 38 fresh, only one rotten, and 90% of audiences, pretty good scores. But then, as I said before, the movie didn't have many fans at the box office. Well, Bev, I know you've seen this movie twice, maybe more than twice, but what are your thoughts on this viewing?
This was the second time I've seen it, and I definitely enjoyed it more this time. In fact, I found it thoroughly delightful. I could concentrate more on all that crackling dialogue rather than this somewhat overly convoluted plot. I can't recommend it highly enough. I was revisiting some of the clips while I was prepping for the podcast, and it was so tempting to just watch the whole thing from the beginning all over again.
And it is available on YouTube, also on Netflix, but fans do not watch it on Netflix because we tried to, and they have it stretched out to fit your 1.85:1 ratio TV. The DVD we have is way better, so that's what we ended up watching anyway.
Yeah, the public domain versions are not amazing.
The YouTube version is better than what we saw on Netflix, though.
Okay, wow.
So let's get into the plot right away. Howard Hawks, the director of this film, I'm going to quote M. Night Shyamalan again. People hack on that guy all the time, but he made a point I thought was very relevant about The Godfather, that he thought that movie kept its tone the whole way through better than any other film, and he thinks that's the director's main job. Well, putting the camera in the right place is a pretty important job, too, but he thinks tone's most important. This one has got the silly comedy combined with a murder storyline about a guy who's going to be killed. He's going to the gallows the next morning. Does Howard Hawks maintain his tone?
You know, the first time I saw this film, my main problem with it was that it goes from being crackling and witty and hilarious to suddenly taking a pretty dark turn when the story starts focusing on Molly and Earl, Earl being the convict about to be executed and Molly being his heartbroken girlfriend. And it really became a struggle when Molly jumps out the window, tries to kill herself, fails, but certainly has injured herself. That's a point where the movie just gets far too serious to continue laughing at the situation, because they're playing very straight, those two characters, It's just hard to laugh at their predicament and their situation. It picks back up and it gets funny again later and, you know, all's well that ends well. But I would say if there's one flaw with this movie, it is the tone.
You know when all that's happening? The middle of the film, which is the problem for most movies. Mm. The beginning and ending may be great, but the middle is the problem. And guess who's not in a big chunk of the middle of the film, apart from a few times he's on the phone?
Cary Grant.
Cary Grant. Even though Rosalind Russell is great in this film, and Howard Hawks didn't even want her, tons of people were up for the role. I guess they all passed on it. Carol Lombard, Katherine Hepburn, Claudette Colbert, Ginger Rogers, Jean Arthur. Jean Arthur had worked with Hawks a few times, or at least once before, for sure, and Hepburn had too. Russell's best-known role would be Auntie Mame. She did about, not quite 20 years later. But I think she's very good in this film, actually, and she really controls the room. In those sequences when Grant's not in the movie, when she's dealing with the other reporters, they're pretty good actors. They do a good job as a, not Greek chorus, but this combination of people who have the same job she does. And she dominates them, not being a bitch about it, mm-mm, but she really does control the room.
Yeah, she has this incredible swagger, and one of my favorite things about this movie is that originally the role of Hildy in the play that it's based on the front page, the role of Hildy is a man. He's going to marry a woman, and they're just trying to keep their ace reporter from leaving them and moving to Albany. Howard Hawks was doing a line reading with his secretary who was reading for the character of Hildy. It gave him the idea that dialogue would sound great coming out of a woman. Katherine Hepburn was on that list, and even Claudette Colbert, I think both of those actresses would have done a really amazing job with it. But you just have to have an actress that can carry the character as if she's a man. And I know I say that is really loaded, but in the 40s, a man would just walk in and own the room. A man who's that witty, who's that good at his job, would not have any problems behaving with that kind of swagger and that kind of confidence. And she does. She just owns it. Nobody ever acknowledges that anything about her stands out from any of the other reporters. They don't make her gender an issue. So she doesn't make her gender an issue, and it's almost as if she's playing the role like she's a dude.
They seem to have full respect for her.
Yeah.
And this whole thing about she's back, and they seem to always be saying in the back of their minds, great, even though they're competitors, obviously, there's a part of them that wants her to be part of this rabble of reporters.
Well, apparently, the only dialogue that got changed to accommodate the gender change was adding the romance, the ex-wife business with Walter, and changing the character to Bruce. Of her fiance, who was a woman, obviously.
Bruce Baldwin.
Yeah.
He has a great interest in the film. Not very long into the film when we first meet Ralph Bellamy. His first line is hilariously earnest. And then Molly, you said her earlier, she's also a picture of pathos, as she should be. Like we say, this movie does have that conflict between a very dramatic story and a very silly, funny one. But Bellamy, right off the bat, you want to either caress him or punch him because he doesn't belong in this film. Maybe because I've seen it 3 or 4 times now, I know that's going to happen. But yeah, and then like I said in the nutshell, Cary Grant is awful to him. He puts him in jail a few different times, or has him put in jail, I should say, a few different times. Has his wallet stolen from him.
It's terrible to his mother.
Yes, he's not a good ex-husband. Now let's get back to the romance stuff, though, for a second. What is a girl Friday? I've often wondered that. I've heard that term many times. Well, it's an assistant who carries out chores for someone else, and that comes from Robinson Crusoe. Mm-hmm. So she is his girl Friday, even though she's on his level, and his ex-wife at one point, they're equals in that sense. He is her boss, so she doesn't have to take orders from him. And maybe that's part of the problem with her, too. She doesn't want to take orders from this guy because she loves him and likes him at the same time, probably respects him, but also, you know, fuck you to a certain extent. But this is a comedy of remarriage and one of those one last job pictures at the same time. Screwball comedy is really just that, a comedy of remarriage. It doesn't even take 5 minutes to see that the remarriage in this film has to take place. There are a lot of movies in the modern era even where people either don't get along in the beginning or they were together at one point and don't get along, maybe even hate each other. Common sense says they're going to end up at the end of the film kissing, maybe even more, before it's all over with. But in this one, you can see right away, she does not belong with Bellamy's character. Of course she belongs with Walter Burns. Although, when it's over and then he's re-proposed to her, they're going to go to Niagara Falls for a honeymoon. Is this marriage really going to last? Remind me of Rear Window. We said on that podcast when it's over, Jimmy Stewart has finally accepted Grace Kelly. She's played by his rules, but are they really going to gel long term? The next day in the course of that movie, I don't know that they're still going to end up together because she's still not what he really wants. And in this film, is Hildy going to actually be insane enough about the job the way that Walter is to stick it out long term, not just for a few weeks or a month, even though she obviously has a certain addiction to this lifestyle too?
Well, the real romance in the film is not between her and Walter, although that's great because they're really evenly matched in their wits. It's between Hildy and her career as a newspaper man. That's the lure. That's what seduces her. So when she ends up with Walter in the end, really what she's accepting is that she can't move to Albany and become a mother. She has to be a journalist. So maybe that is what's going to make her happy. Mm. And when their plans to get married in Niagara Falls get ruined again by a strike.
In Albany.
In Albany, yeah. She is just as excited about that story. Maybe not quite as not excited. Quite excited. But she gets it, and she missed that life, and she missed the adrenaline rush. And they really convey it well in the film. You're so caught up in the dialogue, and there's just such a love of language, and you can watch it over and over again and just pay attention to what they say. I mean, you have to pay attention because they're talking over each other in this incredible rat-a-tat way that you're never going to catch every joke and every word on your first viewing, which is makes it fun. It makes it fun to watch it over and over again. But while this movie is selling this lifestyle to Hildy, it's selling it to us too, and it does a great job of putting you in the place and convincing you that this rush of adrenaline and that rush that you get from being the first person to break a story is the lure, is attractive, and is worth giving up that calm life in Albany for.
She has to be a member of the Morning Post, which is the newspaper. And this is a movie about newspapers. How antiquated is that? Although the Best Picture winner from earlier this year, Spotlight, was also about newspapers. But then there's the cynical opening card that Hawks puts in the movie, the Dark Ages of the Newspaper Game, is what it says. And that was back in 1940, when newspapers were still the main mass media. Television was in our future. Radio was a big factor. Podcasts were way in the future. We're talking 70 years before they'd become a factor. Or maybe 60 years. But we've also got journalists as both heroes and heels. Not just because Walter is a heel through a lot of the film, but then these people do the right thing, and they help out this guy who would otherwise have been hung by the neck. And there's corrupt city officials, and they bring that to light. The movie would probably always be best known for the improvising, and then especially the fast, overlapping dialogue. They used multiple mics to get that, and then Robert Altman, many years later, the other guy's known for overlapping dialogue, perfected that with the sound system where he had everybody mic'd. But it was one of the harder parts about this movie. Maybe that's why it's only in four sets. This is the first New York film we've had since Kramer vs. Kramer nearly 3 months ago. We had so many in the Top 100 project. Now here we finally have one after 3 months off from that city. But it might as well be any city because we never really go into New York streets. We have a newspaper office, a restaurant, the press room at the courthouse, and then a jail cell. And I think that's it for sets.
But that could also be from the fact that it was adapted from a play. And plays are forced to limit their locations because there's only so many sets you can fit on a stage.
But most movies want to open up a play that gets turned into a movie. And this one did not.
That's true.
And Hawks was smart that way. But he was a workhorse. He made so many different kinds of movies. Westerns and comedies and dramas and everything you can imagine. So maybe he thought, well, in this case, I better be true to what this was, which was a stage play.
So even though they stayed true to the play, Hawks encouraged his actors to improvise. And so Russell, who was disappointed by the volume of dialogue that she received in the film, hired a writer to punch up her dialogue and then would slip those extra lines in on set. She admitted as much in her, I think, in one of her memoirs.
Well, if you've been told to improvise, why not throw in dialogue that's been carefully written and then make it look like it's improvised?
And then it makes her look better because it gives her a bigger part in the film and it gives her clever lines to say.
Hollywood's a strange place. There are so many people out there that would say, if it makes the movie better, I don't care whose idea it is or who wrote it or anything else, let's just make the movie better. But there's a lot of other people out there that it has to be my idea or his idea or the big boss's idea. Make sure we kiss ass to the big studio guy. In this case, it sounds like Hawks just said, I want to make the best movie I can, so wherever the fuck it comes from, let's go with it.
But she kept it a secret that she was doing it. Apparently there was a little friction between Hawks and Russell because it was very obvious to her that casting her was a compromise. He didn't really make a secret of it and apparently wasn't all that generous with her on set. So she kept that to herself, but apparently Cary Grant knew and would make fun of her for it.
Hepburn, Grant, and Hawks were together on the Top 100 Project movie that we covered, Bringing Up Baby. And we talked a lot about this film when we covered that one. And I said then I thought this film was better. I still feel that way. But I also said this film was more rewarded by the AFI in general, and I was surprised that that one made the list and this one did not. But I was wrong about that as we did the numbers. Bringing Up Baby was more rewarded by the AFI by a mile. Between the two, which do you like better? And before you answer, keep in mind, Hepburn could have played this role. Do you think she could have played it as well as Rosalind Russell did?
Yes. I think Hepburn would have made a great Hildy. I think Rosalind Russell made a great Hildy, but she's almost channeling Hepburn. Maybe that's just what she was like, but to me, she seems very much like Katharine Hepburn. Hepburn had that confidence. She just had that authority about her that she could have pulled this
but
off.
But she was box office poison back then, so she wouldn't have gotten the role, I guess.
Between the two films, that's a tough call. watching His Girl Friday made me want to go back and watch Bringing a Baby again.
Okay. It never hurts when a movie is so easily available on YouTube, because bad print or not, if you can watch it anytime you want to for free, you're probably likely to think, all right, let's just watch His Girl Friday again. It's right there. So how about we get back to the dark part of the film, though, the political themes that ring very true, especially this year, where a guy is burying the truth about something. This guy could be set free, but he wants to keep a secret to help his political career. And then the Pettibone character who has the information, he's pretty funny too.
Remember yeah. that guy comes yeah, in? Yeah, the messenger.
Good. Do shoot the messenger, I guess, in that case. Well, he didn't do anything wrong. There are also a few slaps at Hitler. We are talking pre-war, at least America's involvement in war. Almost 2 years away from that, in fact. And a few references to Reds and even Russia. But what about the subtext, the subplot of the execution? And we find it around the midway point of the movie that he didn't even do anything at all, and it's going to be covered up.
It's tough because it's such serious subject matter. I wish that they had chosen a story to chase where the stakes were lower. And then I also feel like the casting of John Quaylen as Earl Williams perhaps was miscasting. He's just too pathetic. He's too earnest. There's nothing funny about him whatsoever. And I know there's nothing funny about the situation, but a good actor, good writing could overcome that or just take it in a different direction somehow. He's so pathetic. It brings the movie down and it takes you out of this happy place where you're just having a good time. It's the flaw in the film. It's the reason probably why the AFI chose Bringing Up Baby over His Girl Friday.
Even though Hawks himself said the problem with that film is that there is no normal person in the whole thing, including Cary Grant. They're all a little bit nuts. And he realized from that point on, one of them has to be the cipher for everything else to make it work. The Lady Eve is a great example of that. Henry Fonda, who was never known for comedy and didn't do very many comedies, is the normal one in that film. And yet he's still funny, especially when he does pratfalls, ironically, because he's not known for pratfalls especially. And that wasn't a Hawks movie, that was Preston Sturges, but great example of you have to have at least one guy in the film who's not doing or saying anything funny. It's not a comedy to him at all. But speaking of comedy, there's some inside jokes that you probably didn't get and a lot of people wouldn't. I only know about some of these things because I read them online. But then I also know Ralph Bellamy is the guy playing that character. Yeah. Cary Grant even says at one point, he looks at that actor, Ralph Bellamy.
I know. You laughed at that so hard.
That's a pretty good little moment. Grant also calls a guy Archie Leach. Well, Archibald Leach is Cary Grant's real name. And then he references Mock Turtle. He had played the Mock Turtle from Alice in Wonderland in a film, I think probably in the 30s it must have been. And that's when Williams is in the role Top Desk.
So there's some meta jokes in there.
Mm.
1940.
Which you didn't see all that often until very recently that people have such meta stuff. Maybe the 80s is when that really got going, but here's a movie, 1940, that did that. So a bit more about the cast. The big star, Cary Grant, he was in the prime of his career at this point, but was he miscast as a primo jerk? He's so good in this film because he was such a good actor, and he's one of those actors, I've admitted this before, when I first saw him in films, I didn't think he was all that great. I do now that I've seen some of his movies multiple times. Do you think he was miscast being an asshole?
No, because he has the charm to pull it off. He just can make being an asshole somehow seem endearing, because he's just that charismatic.
I just thought of somebody comparatively, maybe, character about 20 years later. John Hamm in Mad Men. Not funny, it's not a comedy per se, but there's a complete son of a bitch asshole who's charmed most people in his office, at least for a while, until they really start disliking him maybe towards the end. Well, even then, they don't really dislike him, let's face it. But it's a good-looking guy who's very smart. He's got a good sense of humor, well, within the Mad Men context. Is that a fair comparison, maybe?
I would be more inclined to compare him to somebody like Harrison Ford or George Clooney. People always call George Clooney
the character. Well, I meant the character John Hamm plays, not John Hamm himself. I mean, the actual just character.
I guess so, but he's not like Burns.
Well, true. John Hamm, actually, is quite funny in reality and seems like a pretty good guy.
He would be more like the John Slattery character in Mad Men because he's just so rat-a-tat funny that he gets away with murder because he's charming.
But he's an asshole who only wants to get his own way. You're right. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. John Slattery and Mad Men. Better comparison. Hawks and Grant made 3 movies in 3 straight years. Bringing Up Baby was 1938. Only Angels Have Wings in 1939 with Gene Arthur, which is why they thought about putting her in this film. And then His Girl Friday in 1940. But then they didn't do another movie again together until 1949.
Incidentally, Gene Arthur was so hell-bent on not working with Howard Hawks again, or just not doing His Girl Friday for whatever reason she had, that she was suspended by the studio.
No, Columbia did that, huh? Yeah, that's funny. You think back in that era when people had contracts with studios. That doesn't really happen now. Maybe it never happens now, actually.
Yeah, they're all free agents now.
They tend to make a lot more money than they ever did back then. Russell, we agree, was very good in the film. Ralph Bellamy, he's funny, I think. Career second banana. If you don't recognize that name, or maybe you think you might when we talk about him, or maybe you see his face in some of the clips online, Think of him in Trading Places and then Pretty Woman. He's the guy that Richard Gere has to romance, not literally romance, but to get his business from so he can chop it up into smaller pieces. As for John Quayle and as Earl Williams, the Death Row guy, he was in three big AFI movies, Grapes of Wrath, Casablanca, and The Searchers. He's the guy in The Searchers that plays Vera Miles' father with a Swedish accent. And then Hawks, the director, only did bring up Baby for the AFI list, but Rio Bravo, Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie, or at least one of his favorite movies, and dozens more. The guy made so many fucking movies. What have you thought of this director's style in these two films? And maybe you've seen other things he's done.
Okay, I've only seen the two films, but what I've seen is a very highly competent technical director. He has great pacing. He obviously works well with actors. He has a great ear for language, for script. Obviously has good taste. He may not be the most inspired director of all time, but there's so much to be said for somebody who gets how to make a film properly.
There's a big recurring line in Rio Bravo that John Wayne has about professionalism. He's got professionals working with him to save the day. That's a bit of a dig at High Noon. Wayne and Hawks didn't like that this guy's begging for help on the whole film. Gary Cooper, that is. So maybe that plays into what he was as a director.
The two films that I've seen, at least, both films have characters that are very passionate about their careers. Bringing up Baby, he's a paleontologist. He's very serious about that. And obviously, His Girl Friday is all about the lure of a profession and how much you care about doing your job well. That competence can be energizing and addictive.
And getting the news out to the public. So Hawks also does two comedies in this case, and not a lot of directors back in that era were great at comedies. Even the ones that did comedy on a fairly regular basis were maybe not that great at it.
This movie is 76 years old, and we still laughed out loud watching
times.
It. And that is not even something I can say for many modern comedies that come out today.
I think that's why it stuck in my mind to do this when we got to this point of the project, when we're still in the early 40s or probably sometime in the 30s of the Top Runner project. We did quite a few comedies at that point, and not that many of them made us laugh out loud. And I was thinking about the fact that this film has that ability that when you do laugh, it isn't constantly the laugh fest, of course, because of the subplot. But when you do laugh, it tends to be a big guffaw type of laugh. It isn't like, that's kind of funny.
No, it's
bona fide. That was fucking good, man. That was funny.
That unintentional laugh that you don't even see coming. Cary Grant is so funny. He really was a comedian. And like they say, you know, comedians can always pull off drama as well. Comedy is harder than drama. So if you're good at that, you're probably good at everything. He just nails it. Every nuance of his performance is just so winning and amusing, and he gets the best laughs in the movie. Except for maybe The Messenger.
Right. Even though he's playing a manipulative jerk.
Like a sociopath, but right. A charming one.
And he isn't sexist per se, but
he's not sexist at all, really. It's actually really refreshing, and even by today's standards, that there's this kind of reversal of the typical Hollywood formula of a professional woman who's too caught up in her job to find love, and then is convinced to settle down by Mr. Right. This is the complete opposite of that Hollywood cliche where instead you have a woman who's trying to settle down but is lured by professionalism and her own competence.
We like the word competence today, don't we?
Okay, I'm overusing the word competence. I don't have the screenwriting skills.
Of Charles Lederer.
Hey, how about that segue?
He wrote Kiss of Death in the later 40s. Not a funny movie. The dark subplot we see in this movie is into that one. It's the plot. And he wrote a few other things for Hawks. He based it on The Front Page, which we talked about already, the 1928 stage play by Ben Hecht, who was very well known in this era, and Charles MacArthur. And then Hawks was his own producer, so they're the people behind the camera and the creative roles, the technical people behind the camera in this 1:3:3:1 black and white film. And as I said before, watch the DVD, do not watch on Netflix. The cinematographer, Joseph Walker, who shot Capra's Big Three, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, It's a Wonderful Life, and It Happened One Night. And he also shot The Awful Truth, so he did some pretty impressive black and white films in this era. The editor, Gene Havlick, worked on It Happened One Night, Mr. Smith, and then won the Oscar for Lost Horizon. All of those for Capra.
And I gotta jump in and compliment the editing of this film, considering it was 1940. It certainly wasn't a new art, but, you know, the camera's really stuck in certain positions, and there's only so much they could do with it. if you watch the way some scenes are cut and that they'll pace very slowly and then jump back and forth, a great example would be when they're in the press room in the courthouse. Earl is in the roll top desk and it plays out very slowly, and then as soon as everybody realizes what's happening, it's just rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat, very quick cutting, but never feels jumpy. It's just perfect. The pacing in this film is so excellent. It's such a big part of what makes a film work, and they never lose that from beginning to end.
It's about 90 minutes long, so they get through a lot in a brief period of time. Mm-hmm. But when you talk this fast and over each other, the music, there really isn't any. You got some at the beginning and some at the ending. The two guys, Sidney Kuttner and Felix Mills, are uncredited, and I know you like the fact that there is no music. There really doesn't need to be.
No, there really doesn't need to be. You don't miss it at all.
All right, so influence, and there's quite a bit. The 1930 Howard Hughes version of the film, where Hildy was a man, and then also 1974, they did the front page. Billy Wilder directed that, and he used his old friends Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. Lemmon was Hildy. Switching Channels in 1988 with Burt Reynolds and Kathleen Turner has the same storyline, but that's about television. And then rom-coms and screwball comedies in general. This was one of the many films that would have started to really influence those movies as they came along. Preston Sturges must have been inspired by people in the 30s like Howard Hawks, and not so much Screwball, but Capra and those kinds of guys. Probably not so much the Marx Brothers, but those guys had been perfecting the way comedies were being done in the sound era after Chaplin, Keaton, and Harold Lloyd had perfected silent comedy. Now here you've got people that are talking 100 miles an hour, so what a difference from what had been happening before. And speaking of the overlapping fast dialogue, that's, as I said in the podcast we did for Jaws, a big part of Jaws, and people never really want to talk about that more than I do, but I think it's an important part. Spielberg really doesn't ever do that in another movie that I can think of, but he did there in one of his very biggest hits ever, and it does feel real. You got to pay more attention. Robert Altman's the one that did it more than anyone else, though, after Howard Hawks. And speaking of directors that Howard Hawks influenced, it's really surprising that Quentin Tarantino, who's an absolute devotee of this guy, hasn't done more overlapping dialogue in his films. But one thing that had to be inspired by this movie is the Beatrice and Bill conflict in Kill Bill, especially the second part. The whole you're better than this thing where he says she's Superman and she's hiding out from the world with her Clark Kent identity. Okay, that's inspired obviously by the Superman comic, but the idea that somebody's not living up to their potential and this guy's going to make her do it, although that gets a lot more bloody and awful in that film, that had to be a little bit inspired by His Girl Friday.
That's a good point. I like that. Because and I love Kill Bill.
As much as Cary Grant is a dick in this film, there's a bit of that subtext going on that, no, I got to get her back here. Not just because I want her. That's obviously a reason. Also because he wants her, but because he knows she's great at this and she's going to waste her time doing that thing where she's just raising babies for some schlub in Albany.
As much of a dick as Cary Grant is in His Girl Friday, David Carradine's a way bigger dick in Kill Bill.
All right, so the awards on the AFI list, there were no Oscar nominations for the picture, but this is pretty impressive. The 1993 National Film Registry group of films included, along with His Girl Friday, An American in Paris, Blade Runner, The Godfather Part II, It Happened One Night, A Night at the Opera, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, Shane, and Yankee Doodle Dandy, all AFI films, not His Girl Friday. That might be the biggest group of AFI films in 1 year. Well, maybe the first couple years was more. But considering we were 4 years into their grouping of films, 25 each year, not a bad combination of great titles that they included in 93. His Girl Friday, like we said, was 19th in the Top 100 Laughs, and it was nominated for the Top 100 Passions. I think I probably should have made that, and the Top 100 Genres in the rom-com category, but there's only 10 of those, so should it have made that? I think Bringing Up Baby probably did, so Hawks and Grant were represented there at least. All right, well, last thoughts on a big difference from last week, The Empire Strikes Back, and next week's picture, too. We're really jumping around, and that's part of the point of what we're doing here in the Next 100 Project, because we can do whatever the fuck we want. But what did you think of His Girl Friday, parting thoughts?
I think it deserves its place among the best of all-time screwball comedies. This second viewing for me has definitely proved it really rewards watching it over and over again. And it's 76 years old and we were still laughing out loud. It's a damn good movie.
There are other comedies from that era I do want to cover at some point, and maybe one or two more before the year is over. But this is definitely one of the tops that they didn't include in the original list. Philadelphia Story, which I actually don't like as much as this one. The same year as this film, actually.
Yeah.
Also Cary Grant, Anne Hepburn, and Jimmy Stewart.
I may be meh about whether I like this better than Bringing Up Baby, but I definitely like it better than Philadelphia Story.
And you didn't like Sullivan's Travels, and I didn't like as much as I thought I would. And this does top some of the movies that made that list, for sure. And it's around the same level as some of the other ones that made the AFI lists in 98 and 2007. Okay, well, when you hear our voices in a week, we're going to take another viciously hard left turn. We'll take a peek at David Fincher's monumental serial killer film, Seven. Or, as Doug Benson on his podcast said recently, S-E-7-E-N. The coming attractions trivia for Seven. How many of the seven deadly sin murders are carried out on screen?
Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. Please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. Ryan and I are both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, SparkplugCoffee.com.
The podcast is over. Perhaps we better go. Maybe up to Niagara Falls, but that will stop in Albany on the way.
And cut.
You pay the way.